This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
As always, I want to thank the Pardes Institute, pardes.org.il, for helping to make this class happen. Okay, so we are still in the Gaonic period. I want to actually more or less wrap it up today. As you guys know, the in the davar sof, there's really no end to the depth of detail that we could bring forward to try to study things sort of as a topic unto themselves. But my interest here is really in the personalities that shape the Jewish story. Not just the personalities, but the currents of thought, right, and the narrative elements. So we're going to pick up today. The major focus is going to be Rav Sadia Gaon, who we mentioned at the end of last class. And I want to try to make a bridge a little bit to what was happening in Spain toward the end of the Gaonic period. That's kind of the big picture for now. But in order to get started, I just want to make sure we're clear on the building blocks that we've laid for the Gaonic period. Right? So number one, as an institution, the Gaonet, right, is they are the heads of the academies. So they are the sort of intellectual, spiritual leadership of Babylonian Jewry. And we spoke last week, about the twin struggles for hegemony between Babylon and the land of Israel, which we'll return to when we get to Rav Saadia's bio, right? And the Babylonians, and what was the other place they were struggling for hegemony? Not just with the land of Israel, but the Karaite schism, right? That really the rabbinic project reaches its full form under the hands of the Gaonim. Remembering that my contention is that the rabbinic project is this idea that there is a one-to-one relationship between law and identity. That what a Jew is what a Jew does. Even though, as a couple people pointed out, there's still, of course, the Gaonim are going to agree with what we consider a biological origin of Judaism, meaning they believe in matrilineal descent, that someone born to a Jewish mother is a Jew. That itself, as we pointed out, is a halachic construct. And wherever one thinks it comes from and whatever its roots are, meaning in the end of the day, that's got to be adjudicated, certainly in the 8th, 9th, 10th century before genetics were even a concept, right? So the Gaonim represent the full form of this identity of a one-to-one relationship between law and identity, right? And because of that, they fought the battle with the land of Israel over minhag, you recall, right? That there it wasn't just a question of who's right or who's wrong in certain halachic matters. It was a question of which style of Judaism is going to be the central style. Right, that the sages of Eretz Yisrael were on the ropes historically in terms of the supremacy and learning that had clearly shifted to Babel quite some time ago. And nevertheless, because of the power of the sort of the Holy Land, because of the antiquity of the Jewish settlement there, and because of their position relative to Europe, right, if you recall that even legally within the Muslim Empire, the land of Israel was recognized as its own domain, its own reshut, right? That Lebanon, Syria, they don't really exist as countries, but the area of Lebanon and Syria, the land of Israel and Egypt, were their own reshut, and that in particular they had a heavy influence on Italy and what would become Ashkenaz. And we'll come back to the Ashkenaz connection a little bit more when we get to the proper Ashkenaz story. But there is a struggle for minhag. Now it's worth it actually to say one more word about that, or repeat really. Right? What does the word minhag mean? What you're used to doing, and what else did you say? No. That's chag is with a chet, right? No, that's okay. Trust me, I've done way worse. Right? Noheg is behavior. Like, nagut is behavior. Linhog, I heard somebody say in modern Hebrew is to drive, right? Nihiga, right? Minhag is what you do. Now, here's the thing, is that you'll find a very interesting dichotomy when it comes to minhag. We saw that in the battle between the sages of Eretz Yisrael and the sages of Babylon, that the major argument that the sages of Eretz Yisrael brought forward is minhag okeret halacha, that minhag, custom, has the power to actually uproot established law, right? And that was brought forward as a protection because the Gaonim claimed that the halachic tradition of Eretz Israel was really sort of a string of emergency measures and patchwork, you know, sort of makeshift practices that were a result of a very bad 500 years under the Greco-Roman Empire, which is a fair estimation. The answer of the sage of Eretz Yisrael is, but minhago keret halacha, that halacha is never an abstract intellectual process, it's an organic lived one. So the Gemara itself will say, minhag Yisrael torahi, that what the Jews do is the Torah, which is a very powerful, beautiful, and somewhat problematic statement. Because the other face of minhag is a statement attributed to Rabbeinu Tam, one of the Tosfos, who we will get to know, please God. And he says, minhag otiot gehenom. Right? That you can rearrange the letters of minhag and you get to hell. What's he mean? He said, if you think about it, giving the answer that we do because that's what we do, is a potentially very dangerous way of approaching life. Right? And yet, minhag Yisrael torahi is also a very powerful way of living life. One of the big themes that's going to become more and more pressing, actually, as we move deeper into the Rishonim era, right? Once this central, you know, the Goyim fight the battle become the central culture, but then that central culture itself is going to be shattered and broken up in the early Middle Ages into Spain, North Africa, Babel will continue. There'll be other centers that we're going to speak a little bit about as we go forward, right? But once that happens, then the coherence within each community of its practice becomes increasingly important. What do I mean? There's something called the mimetic tradition. Right? There's a great essay, by the way, I encourage you all to read by Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, because Rav Aaron wrote it. He's a historian, right? Or is that Rav Chaim? Rav Chaim Soloveitchik is the historian. Yeah, thank you. Ray's son. Yeah, there's an amazing essay called Rupture and Reconstruction, which if you haven't read it, is actually very important for understanding the world of Orthodoxy today. And there he makes an observation that there are two sort of forces within Jewish culture. There's the mimetic force and then the book-learned tradition. What's mimetic? Mimetic comes from the same root as memory. Is that, or mime, sorry, imitation, sorry, not memory, right? It's we do what we do because it's what we've always done, right? That you know, my great aunt, she should be healthy and well. So a survivor grew up in a small village in the Carpathian Mountains with a religious family. And she knows kashrut as well as anyone I know. But I'm willing to bet that if I started to ask her detailed questions about it, she would not be able to answer me. Exactly. Yes. So she's doing what she does because that's how her mother did it.
Yes. But this raises the whole thing about the whole thing of the transmission of the oral law. If, for example, the old joke about somebody doing something ridiculous many, many years ago.
Right, cutting the ends off the chicken and putting it in the pot.
In a more serious point of view, that's the kind of thing that's liable to happen. And how can one reconcile that with the transmission of oral law?
I don't think you have to reconcile it. The question is, what's the purpose of the transmission of the oral law? Meaning, let me get these two images out, and then I'll answer your question. One is this mimetic tradition that we do what we do because we learn to do it in an organic, unbroken chain, and it depends on continuity, right? Which is why it's such a challenge to the community in Eretz Israel, which is claiming continuity, but the Babylonian, the Gaonim are saying back to them, yeah, you guys have been sort of broken and reconstructed many times over the centuries. The other side of the equation is the book-learned tradition, which is, I'll give you the example that Rav Chaim says there in his essay, that, you know, the Vilna Gaon in the 18th century was one of the more important thinkers amongst the Achronim who spent energy on what are called Shiurei Halacha. Today it's like everybody's mad about it, but about the measures within law. How much wine do you have to drink in order to make kiddush? How much matzah, of course, do you have to eat, right? The answer is an entire box at this point, right? How big, et cetera. All these questions in law, which are real questions, because if you're going to say you have to eat matzah, the first Jew that hears that is going to pop up and say, how much? What do you mean by eat? right? Can I wrap it in plastic and swallow it? What if I take it intravenously, right? This is the way it works. But nevertheless, there's an interesting phenomenon that for when the Gra wrote about Shiurei Halacha, apparently there was not so much interest in his works. Why? Because you know how the average person knew how much they had to drink for Kiddush? They had a cup. And where did they get that cup from? From their father, who got it from his father. At some point, obviously, somebody bought it. But the idea is, on some level, you know because it's what you do. On another level, you can't come and tell me, just because you happen to look at my cup, Rabbi, that no man in my family for the last 10 generations has actually made Kiddush. Because it happens to be we have a very small Kiddush cup, right? It doesn't work that way, right? You understand that there's a deep question which lies at the heart of your challenge here, is that is what matters actual abstract content? No, if you do not have 150 milliliters in that cup, or 85.6, or whatever you hold by, then you have not done the thing, whatever the thing is, right? Kiddush. Or, no, there's something called Kiddush, which is an essential act. And then if you push me, because you can always do that within a legal system, I'll start laying down boundaries about how specifically it should be done, but the details don't define the act. You understand? This is a tremendous tension which is always latent within religious life. And what Rav Soloveitchik points out in that essay is that the disruption of communities that has happened, you know, it began with the destruction of the Second Temple, but the Gaonim are last stop for a centralized community where you could say, tell me, what do the Jews do? And they will tell you, this is what the Jews do. And we see they're fighting milchama panim lachol. They're already fighting battle against the sages of Eretz Israel, and they're fighting a battle against the Karaites, but they're still recognized. They succeed in establishing this notion that we are the Jews. Right? Once this era ends, you'll be able to say we are the Jews of Spain, we are the Jews of North Africa. You'll no longer be able to say we are the Jews. And therefore, this tension becomes all the more extreme. Because I'll give you the great example in history I've mentioned a couple of times. When Spain is destroyed and its elite intellectuals and cultural driving forces are spread throughout the Mediterranean Basin, in particular throughout the Ottoman Empire, all these people will show up in town and the locals will look at them and say, funny, you don't look Jewish. Right? Jews don't wear capes. That's not how we do it around here. And the halachic literature is filled with this tension. Like, can we pray with these people? Or should we force them to set up their own synagogues? Right? And I mean, gradually the Sfardim, the actual Spaniards, more or less took over most of these sort of native, what are called Edot Mizrach, the sort of Middle Eastern communities, because of, well, their cultural and intellectual momentum. But nevertheless, there's an incredible record of this tension, and this is last stop before the tension between minhag, lived custom, which depends upon continuity, and therefore, by the way, will always suppress. Right, this story that everybody tells about the woman who cuts the, you know, both ends off the chicken and puts it in her pot beforehand, and then she does some research and she finally gets back to her great grandmother, who on her deathbed tells her, "Well, that I just had a too small pot," you know, like meaning that there's a way in which we sanctify what we do, even though it doesn't have any essential meaning, right? That there will always be an incentive within traditional communities to erase that question. That's the ahistorical element you will find certainly within present-day Orthodoxy, right? This idea that nothing ever changes, that what we do now is how we've always done it. Moshe wore strimal at Sinai. And if you've ever seen the benchers of him carrying a Sefer Torah out through Kriyat Yamsuf, that's my personal favorite one. If you think about it, like that one's like really upside down. But you understand that there is no greater sort of psychological need and power of the human mind than to believe that the way things are now are how they have always been. And people who live even through the greatest times of change in history will still insist, as the world is shifting around them, that this is how it has always been. And we're going to see, by the end of the Gaonic period, probably not going to get there today, so I'm not sure why I started there, that this is going to become a pressing issue. I just remind you of my daughter's Dvar Torah about mixing the oil in the water. This is the period at which the globs of oil are going to start to break up. And by the way, in once we get to modernity, it's kind of like hitting the blender. Zzz, you got salad dressing.
On
There's no question that there was a halachic discourse about every one of those questions. Whether it was written down with a continuity and whether the practice is always reflective of the discourse is our own questions. Standard of measure, right? That's a very good question. What you're asking on a certain level is, what's the relationship between custom and law when you're talking about a society that has intellectual masses and an intellectual elite, both of whom see themselves obligated to mitzvot, right? I'll give you an example, right? Your example is a good one, right? The Jews, let's go easy. We're assuming the Jews have been eating matzah at Seder for as long as we've been Jews, right? Now, and assuming everybody always had some notion that you have to eat some amount of matzah, right? There was always the kid at the table who was like, I don't like matzah. He took a little bite and his father said to him, no, you have to actually eat the matzah. And then the argument erupts, how much matzah do you have to eat? That's sort of like the bottom-up perspective. But then you have the rabbis in the Beit Midrash saying, well, what does eat actually constitute? Right? And then we're gonna go through all the examples we have in law, and we're gonna come up with a specific measure. Next thing you know, the rabbi's there in shul saying, everybody tonight when they go home has to eat a sheet and a half of matzah, whatever it is today, right? And the question is, where do those two come in? That really, by the way, that's a deep question in what we call the philosophy of law. And it depends on how you approach the question. To me, the way I was taught is that a kazayit, right, the quantity of matzah you're meant to eat is, and if you look at the context, I think it's quite clear that that's the amount of food that a person who's sick and would actually prefer not to eat, but is now eating in order to show you that they actually value the act of eating, would be able to get down. Now notice, if you push me, you're going to force me into a corner of giving you a number. But the answer I really want you to say is that eat the matzah. But how much? Eat the matzah. I'm not hungry. That's fine. I'm not asking you to eat it because you're hungry. I'm asking you to eat it because you have to. Take a little nibble. That's not eating. You understand? So this problem will not go away. And a lot of it depends on personality. It depends on personal psychology. It depends on also cultural context, right? And there is, I can tell you, the classic Baal Tshuva problem. I don't know if anyone here has made that jump, as I have in my own life, of going from a non-observant to an observant lifestyle. But one of the great challenges is we all navigate by gut in most of our life. When you make a decision or you take an action, you do it because you kind of have a sense of what's right and wrong in a particular situation. Granted, sometimes life teaches us otherwise, but most of us navigate by our gut. What happens when you adopt a religious lifestyle is your gut becomes completely irrelevant, because you weren't raised in this context and you don't actually know what to do. And it can be extremely disempowering, it can be incredibly disorienting, and there's only really two solutions in the short term. You know what they are? Learn or find someone else to tell you what to do. And the two go together, obviously. You can't learn on your own entirely. Right, then people do. You see people who very faithfully, without any judgment, just very faithful, will then simply realize, I know nothing. Not only do I know nothing, what I know is not helping me. So therefore, I will just ask all the time. There are others who will put that same energy into learning. I'm like, I know nothing right now, but I know how to learn. But the goal either way is to basically redevelop a gut feeling of, I don't want to have to open up Shmir Shabbos Kehilchata every time something comes up in my house. I want to be able to know, no, we don't do that here. And I want it on an instinctive level where I don't really know why. I'm not really sure. And if you really push, maybe I'll look it up and I might find. But I know that we don't do that. Right? So this is a much bigger discussion, which I'm now going to rein in, because it was really only one piece of the centrality of custom was one of the fights that the Gaonim had to fight, along with their halachic authority, which is embodied, of course, in their mastery of the Gemara. Right? We also saw their fight over the calendar, which I'll return to briefly when we get to Rav Saadia proper, right? This need to control time, because as I pointed out to you guys, I thought there was some laughter there. I'm just thinking, this is my greatest dream in life, that I could actually control time. remembering that the calendar is the last centralized authority in our Jewish lives, right? That there is no one who argues with all the arguments the Jews have. There is no one who argues about when Pesach falls out this year, which is an incredible accomplishment that we should value and take care of. The last piece, which we didn't mention, which is worth just throwing out there, is the Siddur, right? You know, the Siddur is a very powerful tool. I'm a very big fan. One of the things I sometimes get to teach here and I really love to do is the Siddur. And even when I don't get to teach that, I teach second semester Rav Kook's approach to prayer, which to me is a lot about understanding the Siddur. But what's the word mean?
Order,
right. So the earliest order of prayer that we have in any sort of semblance that we recognize, I mean, the Gemara is filled with many of the elements of modern prayer, is the Seder of Rav Amram Gaon. Rav Amram lived, we assume, somewhere in the mid-9th century. So we're talking about we call it 850, if you want to, the middle of the 9th century. In this case, some of you guys like me have trouble with that 800 9th century thing. And the Siddur was a response, as most of the great works of the Gaonim was, to a question of, like, how do we do this prayer thing? What does the order look like? The challenge is we actually don't have the original of Rav Amram's Siddur. It's been, because it wasn't just an abstract answer, it was actually a book. Like, here you go. Here's a Siddur. And then, of course, it was edited by the various people who received it according to their custom. So there are many what are called many recensions, many versions of it out there. But it was a very important element that the Gaonim fought, as we'll see on a particular field when we get a little further into the Rav Sadia, the coherence and relative unity of the Siddur. I say relative unity because if people are familiar, there are nuschot, or there are different liturgies out there. But they all really are built on the same structure. For all the difference, and if you've ever dropped into the middle of a shul, of a nusach that you don't know, it can be very disorienting. But I warrant you, it's disorienting because you actually feel like you ought to know what's going on. I remember the first time I came to Eretz Yisrael, I had never heard of Nusach Sfard. And I went into a shul. I was only concerned, is it Sfardi or Ashkenaz? I was clearly Ashkenaz, in my eyes. And then, like, things started popping up that were not quite the same as I knew. And I got super confused because I thought I knew where I was. If you dropped me in the middle of a Taimani shul, I would have just figured I have no idea where we are. And I was going to go with it. So the Seder of Rav Amram, I would say, is the third piece, together with the calendar and the Gemara, which is that mastery of law, be it minhag or actual sort of legal text, that allows the Gaonim to set Am Yisrael into one solid story. Right? You have law, you have time, and now you have prayer. And you know, prayer functions in a very important respect, as I'm sure we've mentioned before, that three times daily prayer is the process of saying a story over and over again until it's not just what you know, it's how you live. Right? I'm sure I've mentioned this. I told you the story about getting bit by the dog, for sure. I tell it to everybody, right? That basically the stories that we repeat in our minds are how we integrate our experiences into a coherent life, right? Victimhood is probably the best recognized one. People know, like, oh, that person's stuck in a story of victimhood. Everything that happens is somebody else's fault. They're completely disempowered, you know. And even though you may be, and I'm sure we've had this experience, right? You're there with this person, and they have some, I don't know, minor negative interaction in a grocery store with someone. And you're there with them. You say, well, you know, do you realize you cut that person off? What are you talking about? They were so unfair to me. And it's an interpretive lens that takes what would otherwise be isolated experiences and information and stitches them together into a narrative. Why does this matter? Because the Siddur will unify the story of Am Yisrael wherever they are. Together with the calendar, everybody's telling the same story. And you can leave Spain and go to North Africa or go to Bavel or eventually to Poland or where have you. And once you get over the hump of the Nusach, you'll realize, oh my gosh, we're all telling the same story. And it will orient a way of how does the momentum of the past explain where I am in the present? Right? How did we get here? And when we get to Ashkenaz, we'll see that's a pressing question. How did we get here? Here I am reading the Bible, and yet I'm in the Rhineland, and I'm not really sure what lies in between. Oh, the Siddur actually will answer that question for you. And where are we going? Which is, of course, what everyone really cares about. And the Siddur answers that question as well.
What was the Sfirah for hundreds of years before the Siddur?
Presumably it was the same structure before Rav Amram sent it out. This was, again, just part of that Gaonic process of standardization. I mean, the Gemara already tells us all the basic structures about the Shema and the blessings before and afterwards and the 18 blessings of the Amidah and even elements of Pesukei Dezimra. You know, like, all the classic pieces were there. But this is an effort at standardization because, remember, standardization is power. That the Gaonim were creating a cultural matrix. Right? You get all these pieces, you just add water, and you've got the Jews. And therefore, if you lack one of these pieces, then you're not the Jews. Now go through them, the Sidur, the calendar, and the Gemara. The Sidur, for sure, the Karaites didn't agree with. Because one of the big battles between the sages and the Karaites was over whether you could use non-biblical texts as a source of prayer. Yeah, the Karaites believed in what the Christians call the Psalter. Psalter, right? Psalms. That's what they used. Psalms for prayers. Even though later Karaite texts show that they already deviated. But that was a major battle. So we're going to see it pops up with Rav Sadio as well. Another piece, the Gemara, we've already pointed out, that Anan, from the time of Anan and the original schism, right, it was the rejection of the oral law that they were all about. And even the calendar, some of the Karaites latched on to that old Tzaduki notion that Shavuot has to fall out on a Sunday. And that completely revolutionizes the calendar. I'm just saying, I'm going to finish, because the Torah says, Mimochrat HaShabbat, right, that it's on the day after Shabbat, and it's from the Second Temple period, from the Dead Sea Scrolls, we can see it was a major argument. Does that mean after the first day of Pesach, or is that after Shabbat Breshit? Yes. Yes. Oh, hundreds. Well, we're going to talk about the Gaonim were far more creative in their approach to prayer than we are today. And we're going to speak a little bit about that with Rav Sadia.
Just want to remind everybody that there was no printing at that time. So everyone was copied out. If I can, you can
imagine. So, I mean, it's a critical piece. And as we pointed out, at least from the little evidence we have, that the Gemara was not being copied by the Gaonim. It was being memorized. Right? Well, that was why the Sidur was unique, because they were writing things to send to others, meaning you can't memorize something for someone else. So if you're there in the academies, you can learn what Rav Amram thinks is the proper order of prayer. But if you write a letter from North Africa, then he's going to write you back a tshuva, you know, an answer, and then suddenly you have a Sidur. And the same way the Gemara will function. What do you see to be the importance of that?
Well, the importance of that is that if you repeat it aloud, then you're more likely
to memorize it
in your mind than you are than if your survives just go over the
page. We see, by the way, both biblically and in rabbinic thought, that kriya is out loud.
Yeah.
Hege, yeah, is like a scanning of the lines. Yeah, I know. There's a lot of challenges here. And in the end of the day, you know, in Jewish text, with the exception of the Torah, meaning always trumps syntax, right? In rabbinic text, meaning will always trump syntax, right? So therefore, if we see the Gemara will say, oh, the Mishnah said that, you know, either I have a competing tradition, depending on what you think chosrei michzara means, or I'll tell you how it was actually meant to be read by supplying you with the missing words, right? And why? Because I understand how it fits into the entire string of thought. If you think about how these things are used in the Gemara, there's and it goes all the way down through the halakhic literature, right? The Taut Sofrim. I'm going to tell you this should say the following. Why do you think it should say the following? It's not what it says. Well, because I understand the argument. It's the logic, it's the meaning that drives it, and not a sort of pedantic attachment to syntax, with the obvious exception of written Torah, which is why we create a whole class, a professional class called Sofrim, to make sure that one doesn't change. Okay. Other questions or comments on this sort of introduction before we actually talk about Rav Sadia? In the Torah, there's a big dispute on the issue. We're going to revisit the Masoretes today. Okay. Even when it comes to the text of the Torah, there's a lot of dispute on that. Right? I gave you a very traditional approach that the Torah hasn't changed, but trust me when I tell you that there are rooms full of scholars, many of whom would call themselves traditionalists, who will still tell you that the text of the Torah as we have it today is not exactly how it has always been. That such a thing is actually not possible. Furthermore, they feel quite a bit of internal evidence that it is not so. Okay, other questions or comments? I don't want to rock anybody's theology any further.
Do a different version of the sitter.
I didn't hear what you said.
That's my...
No, I was being serious. Right, but they all have the same core element. The structure is the same. The liturgy changes, right? Nobody's, you know, has 15 blessings in the Shemana Esrei. We have 19 in the 18, but not 15, right? And the structure around Kriyat Shema and the basic four pieces of Shacharit, those don't change. Okay, shall we?
Yeah.
So, Rav Saadia was not born Rav Saadia Gaon, right? He surprisingly enough, right? He was just born as Saadia. Fayumi, he's called, from Fayum, which is in Upper Egypt. Right? He was born in 882. He was born in the 80s, just not of this millennia. And as I pointed out to you, this location of his birth makes him the only non-Babylonian ever to serve as a Gaon. And so I guess we could use maybe as a convenient frame a very simple question. Why? Not why didn't anybody else get to serve as a Gaon. That's we know why, because it was a semi-hereditary meritocracy intellectual elite that wasn't really interested in outsiders. Question is how did he actually get in? Right? So his early education took place in likely in the land of Israel. They locate him, they think, in the Academy of Tiberias. I say they think because there's very little sort of documentary evidence around his early period. But just so you can appreciate where he's headed, I have a quote here from Rabbi Avin by the way, it took me about 15 minutes to say the word decisions correctly in recording this morning. It was driving me nuts. Avraham Ibn Ezra, right, who applied the Tanaic phrase, Rosh Hamedabrim Bekol Makom, the first to speak in all places, right, that Rav Saadia, and it's noteworthy, Ibn Ezra, of course, is located where? In Spain, right? He's already in Christian Spain, and headed north. But Rav Saadia's work is going to find its greatest flowering in Jewish culture in Spain. Even though he has the most immediate impact amongst the Gaonim, in the long run, Rav Saadia's sort of the seeds that he plants will flower in Spain. He starts out in the land of Israel. He there learns a few very important elements. In general, we're going to say that he revolutionizes the literary field within which the Gaonim were. Right? Before Rav Saadia, the Gaonim really only wrote two types of works. One were what we call novella on the Gemara. They're not novella like modern novel, but they call it, I don't know why scholars call them novella. They're chidushim. They're what? Oh, novella just from something new. Oh, yeah, I guess so. I never really thought about that. I just get so stuck in novel. But yeah, that's the whole idea. Chidushim. I guess that's a literal translation of the chidushim. Thank you very much for that. They're always looking in learning. In learning, just to explore the Gemara is infinite and certainly can take up a lot of your time if you let it. So the Gaonim wrote quite a bit about the Gemara as a context for learning. And then, of course, the other major literary work that they had was the responsa. Shailot and Tshuvot, which is the more practical halachic side of the Gemara. And remember, those two sides in learning and law don't separate within the Gemara until one could argue their separation is really what one of the things that defines the shift to the period of the Achronim. So if we ever get there, well, that'll be around the 16th century when legal codes become something different than the learning of the Gemara. But at this point, they are two are the same, meaning you might put emphasis on one side or the other, but it's assumed to be the same endeavor. So that's what all Gaonim basically up until Rav Saadia did. And suddenly when he appears, he brings with him the tradition of Eretz Israel, and it's going to consist of a number of things, one of which is piyutim. Well, piyutim are poems, and apparently actually share a root, if you can hear it, or like some older, either phonetic or actually linguistic, right, between piyut and poetry. You can almost hear it. But let's remember, and I think we mentioned a little bit, because I seem to recall talking about the Kalir in last class, is that the culture of liturgical poetry for the Jews was rooted in the land of Israel. It was rooted in the land of Israel for two reasons. You guys remember what they were? I don't know if they had books more or less than anyone else. Language, they had the Hebrew language far more. There was a flowering. Yeah, we for sure spoke about this last week. Now I remember. Right? There was a flowering of the Hebrew language during what's known as the Byzantine era. Right? So Elazar Kalir, who was the most famous of the Paitanim, right, in the 6th and 7th century, he was a master of Hebrew language at the heart of the Byzantine era. So one is that they had this live connection to the Hebrew language, and the other one is the power of Midrash in the culture of Eretz Israel, right? That the Pew team are often a Midrashic exploration. Poetry is, there are reasons that the modern novel grows out of ballads, right? You know, that poets always depend on some sort of narrative construct to really deliver the depth of their message, right? So Rav Sadia grows up, intellectually at least, seeped in the culture of Piyutim. Now, Piyutim, aside from the sort of standalone ones that we're familiar with, say from Tisha B'Av, or maybe from the Slichot, you know, prayers, right? But Piyutim also serve a very important role in liturgy. Anybody know what the Yotzrot are? Right? There are specific additions that used to be inserted within either the Shemona Esrei or sometimes within the blessings before Kriyat Shema in the morning. There are additions which are seasonal. They're responsive. And we know from Rav Sa'adja onwards that the Gaonim indulged in a much more creative approach to the liturgy than we would be familiar with. It's amazing. The Gaonim actually wrote Piyutim for Tu Shvat. Yeah, they wrote Piyutim, like special, meaning when the person got up, the last vestige that people are probably familiar with is on Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. When the Shalich Tzibor, when the leader gets up to do the repetition of the Shemona Esrei, suddenly they start off into the blue. It's like, wait, that's not what I just said, right? Somewhere immediately within the first bracha, there's all this poetry. And where does it come from? A lot of it is the product of the Gaonic period. Some of that stuff is actually older, but that style of, yes, we all just did our silent Amida in the traditional fashion, but now we're going to, through poetic themes, explore the nature of the day, right? And it was a tremendous art form which Rav Sadia brought into the pale, so to speak, under the Gaonim, because the Gaonim had fought against it up until his period, right? Because they were very, very committed to the halachically binding nature of the specific liturgy and prayer. And that's something which will carry itself out, if we ever get there, into later periods in Jewish history. But through Piyutim, prayer remained timely as well as beautiful. And it's something that, without going on to my own issues, it's worth contemplating in our day, where people often feel that what prayer lacks is a response to the reality I'm actually living, right? And if you see the struggles, if anybody lives in, say, one of the more engaged national religious communities here in the land of Israel, and you see the struggles about what to do on Yom HaAtzmaut and Yom Yerushalayim, people are familiar that every year somebody will publish, or several versions, of like the nighttime on Yom HaAtzmaut. And some of the services I've seen are very beautiful. They're usually structurally very similar to what? Kabbalat Shabbat. They're usually structured, if you look closely, sometimes even using the Lecha Dodi in particular, right? But I don't know about you guys, but unless you happen to be in a place like a yeshiva where everyone's sort of like together and you have time to study it, you know what usually happens? It's incredibly awkward. Because people, on one hand, want to celebrate. They wouldn't be there if it wasn't. On the other hand, everyone has been trained that, no, we don't change anything. So here I am holding what amounts to a heretical document, because we're changing or adding or doing something, which is actually reflective of what I would like to be feeling. Furthermore, it's a complicated thing to feel, because, you know, depending on on what your worldview is and your politics and your religion. You hear them. I every year I have a hard time suppressing the sociologist in me when I'm in, because I just want to daven. I actually find it quite exciting, and it doesn't bother me in the least that we're being creative in the liturgy. I'm always that guy who's over loud in the corner there. But I'm always fascinated by the awkward tension around what amounts to a completely irrelevant, you're not even actually changing anything, you're adding, right? The last major addition to the prayer book that I'm familiar with was Kabbalat Shabbat, and that happened in the 16th century. And if we get there together, which we may, maybe during the Omer, I suggested to Alex, maybe we could look from the Arizal, you know, going forward to say the Baal Shem Tov. There was a reason that it was a revolutionary time that allowed them to make those types of changes. So the Gaonim, on one hand, attempted to suppress this for a couple of centuries. On the other hand, in the end, Rav Saadia brings poetry back to a central place within Jewish culture, including the Piyutim. And going forward, we see up until a certain point in the Middle Ages, especially amongst Ashkenazim, there are Ashkenazim that still do Yotzot today. You can find them in the back of many Ashkenazi Sidurim. And the Sfaradim will keep their own tradition of Paitanim alive and well, even though eventually it will separate from the Nusach. Meaning it becomes less about changing prayer to be responsive and more about just a devotional poetry in and of itself.
Aren't we still doing it with something like Tirat HaMedina, that we pray and then Tirat
HaSahar, Tirat HaMedina? So I don't want to go too much into the structure of prayer, but you'll notice that the prayer for the state and the prayer for the army, prayer for lost soldiers, etc., are all inserted in one very specific place, which is actually not part of the prayer service. It's around the reading of Torah, where it's the reason that we say all those Misha Berachs around the Torah is because it's considered what's called an Eit Ratzon. It's a good time to make requests of God, because here's the Torah and we've just done this incredible act of devotion of reading it. Where you don't find them, just imagine if in the middle of Chole Amo Yisrael, that God should bless the heal the sick of Israel, that the Shaliach Tzibor in the middle of the repetition just broke out with a tremendous prayer for Naftali Ilan ben Shemet Tzipora. On one hand, it's beautiful and timely because he's right now sitting with a bullet in his brain in the hospital. He should be healthy and well, right? He's one of the soldiers that was shot at Givat Asaf. At the same time, I'm willing to bet that nobody in Shul would let him get away with it.
Like,
yes, privately for sure you can do it. But by the way, I would argue that there's probably a lot of space for you even do it as the reader public. And my point was not halachic. My point was cultural and sociological. Is that there's a lot of fear around changing anything at this point within Orthodoxy, for all kinds of reasons that we're not going to go into now. But Rav Saadia was a revolutionary. He brought poetry not only back into prayer, but he brought it back into the mainstream of Babylonian culture. In fact, the earliest book that we have that he published, we don't think it was his first, but it's the earliest one we have, is called the Egron, the Gatherer. And it's a rhyming dictionary, meaning it's a dictionary that rhymes, which is meant to help you with rhyming in poetry. Right, yeah, it's nice, huh? And it basically was meant to assist the composition of poetry and to lift, in general, the contemporary standard of Hebrew, because he brought with him from the land of Israel also this notion that Hebrew must be the language of the Jewish people. It's a very interesting dichotomy within Rav Saadia, actually, right? Because on one hand, the Egron, his book on to assist people writing Hebrew poetry, right? And in the introduction to the Egron, I have a great quote here, which hopefully I can find without too much searching. Oh, come on, don't do this to me. This is the problem when I have this many papers open, right? Hang on one second. Oh, come on. Give me one more minute, and then I'll just give it up. So here it is. Here it is, right? He says in the introduction, there was one language throughout the land, from the days when God created man on the face of the earth until the days of the stormy herd, which is a reference to the Tower of Babel. The holy tongue remained in the mouths of the children of Ever alone because they were found to be true before God. Right, this notion that Hebrew is the Ur language, which is something that I think most Orthodox Jews will tell you, right, really enters into the mainstream of Jewish thought with Rav Saadia. He is the one who pushes, and he begins a Hebrew revival, right, as we'll trace a little bit as we go forward. So on one hand, he is what's that?
No.
Okay. There's no doubt in his mind that Hebrew language is the proper vehicle for the expression of the divine within Am Yisrael. And as we said, it is also an indication of the fact that we have a continuity of culture from the earliest days of creation. Right? It's the primeval language, right? It's a primeval language, and it's indicative of how he reads the Torah. I mean, not just as a text, but as a narrative. On the other hand, well, before we get there, and he elevates this to what we would call the neoclassical longing. Remember, we spoke about this neoclassical instinct that exists in historians, scholars, and average person on the street, that the great era of the world is in the past, and that there's a desire to return to that great. So that great age, I mean, what was the great age of Hebrew literature? Don't say the early 20th century. Right? The prophets. I mean, what could beat Isaiah? Right? The book of Job, according to the Gemara, was not kept because of its theology. It was kept because of its language. If you look how Job is used in the Gemara, it's crazy. It's like, it's the dictionary of the rabbinic mind. It's like, if you don't know what a word means, oh, I saw that in Job once, you know. Look it up. It's worth thinking about. But so he has this sort of a neoclassical longing for a golden age of language, right? And the Egron, his rhyming dictionary, is only one indication, and he brings this with him from the land of Israel. On the other hand, Rav Saadia will translate the Torah and most of the Bible into Arabic. Arabic, right? He will join a rather elite group in making a cultural bridge between the local culture and Jewish culture, right? And his translation of the Bible into Arabic is extremely important for Jewish culture. Remember, at this point, 90% of world Jewry lives under the Islamic Empire, which is not all Arabic speaking, but Arabic is the sort of literary standard. And most of them have been dispersed from the land of Israel for hundreds of years, which means that Hebrew is becoming progressively less accessible to them. And so his translation of the Bible into Arabic allows two things. Number one, for the Bible to become accessible. Number two, it opens the doors wide for legitimate absorption of Arabic culture. Right? And this we are very familiar with. It's happened one time previously, and will happen another time, well, twice, after Rav Saadia. When has this happened? When is the translation of a Torah previously made the Torah accessible to a non-Hebrew-speaking group of Jews and also opened the doors wide to their culture? The Septuagint, when it was translated into Greek. The two times it happens after Rav Saadia are interesting. Moshe Mendelssohn, in what's known as the Biur, his translation into German, right? And last time, Art Scroll. I wasn't going to give King James that credit. But you guys are right. English is a very... If you look at the number of English translations, it's noteworthy how many there were. There were other, by the way, German translations. Martin Buber, for instance. I'm speaking about Jews amongst Jews because the non-Jewish translations have their own agenda. It's not that they don't have impact. Martin Luther's translation of the Bible into German is an important event for world history. And Hirsch, he translates into German? The Bible? Really, that close to Mendelssohn? Interesting, I didn't know that. What? Yeah, but that's pretty close. I did not know that he actually translated. I knew he wrote a commentary. I didn't know he actually translated. What? Hirsch. Okay. Anyway, but either way, if he did, so it even further proves my point, because he was classically looking to open the doors to German culture. So it's a very strange dichotomy within Rav Saadia. On one hand, like I said, he is the neoclassic Hebrew, you know, the early Zionists don't hold a candle to him in this idea of a Hebrew Renaissance. Right? On the other hand, he translates the Bible into Arabic and thereby makes a real bridge between the two cultures. And not only does he translate it into Arabic, you know, we have to remember that Hebrew at this point is a difficult language even for someone of Rav Saadia's stature. So he will rely upon both Arabic grammatical rules. Rav Saadia basically is the originator of Hebrew philology, which is a fun word you can use now with your friends. Right? Philology is the study of how language changes through time. And of course, in order to do that, you have to have text, because you can't study how language changes through time in a spoken fashion without some written or in our era, you know, recorded text, right? And so Rav Saja really begins that process within Am Yisrael, and he doesn't have any native tools at hand. So he, but the Arab culture is a literary culture second to none in his period. And questions of grammar, of how do you actually read a text, he will use Arabic tools to analyze the text, and he will use Arabic words to attempt to understand Hebrew words that he finds obscure, which is both of which are quite controversial. I want to understand why, because they're going to play themselves out in Spain as well. The second one is easier, so we'll go with that. Why is it controversial that he's willing to look to Arabic as a indication of what certain Hebrew terms would mean that he's unfamiliar with? He's making a hashva'ah. He's comparing the two languages. Today we speak of their Semitic languages, Arabic, Hebrew, Amharic, you know, Aramaic. That was not obvious in any way. And furthermore, what is the core text of Arabic in his day? The Quran. So now you're edging closer and closer to comparing two sacred texts, which, remember, in world culture are duking it out. And who's winning? The Quran. Remember, nothing proves like success. And so it's a risky move to make any comparison between the two when the dominant culture has its arms wide open and is inviting the Jews to throw off their tzitzis and come join the team. Right? Nevertheless, why is he doing it? Because he wants to understand the Bible. That's all he cares about on that level. Right? And he got that from Eretz Yisrael as well. Remember, I pointed out to you that it was the Karaites who were the first exegetes of the Bible, that the Gaonim were interested in the oral law. Now, of course, the Gemara does deal with the Torah. We don't want to overstate the case too much. But the Gaonim, certainly before Rav Saja, did not write biblical exegesis. They did not write analytical texts in an attempt to understand the Bible. And to do exegesis properly, you have to have a mastery of grammar. You have to understand the language. You simply, especially in a language like Hebrew, right, where the subtlety of differences in reading, and there aren't even real tenses, right, that if you really want to understand what it's speaking about, you have to understand the language. So on one hand, it's controversial because he's seems to be elevating Arabic in the religious mind. On the other hand, you know why it's controversial to use rules of grammar at all? I don't care where you get them from. Why would it be problematic to pose the grammatical rules in the Torah?
Well, because if we believe that it was God's word as God spoke it, who are we to be editing it?
You're binding God by the rules of grammar. If you argue grammatical rules, you're essentially saying God could not have said it otherwise. That's the first step. And the next step is, I actually know what it really means. The third step is almost inevitable. As soon as you start understanding language, not as a revealed text, but as a means of communication which has universal rules that you can find in Arabic and you can find it in Hebrew, and eventually in Spain they'll find it in Latin as well, you're going to start asking some very deep questions about what does it mean that God spoke to Moshe? Right? And this why, by the way, along with the Rambam, the grammarians will always be the spearhead of heresy into the heart of traditionalism. Because on one hand, everybody wants to understand the Bible. And we know if you can't read it properly, you can't understand what God said. And if you don't know the rules of grammar, you're not reading it properly. But as soon as you say that phrase, the rules of grammar, you are already starting to bind God's hands and to enter into this realm of the sort of the intercultural assumption that there are rules that transcend revelation. So where did Aramaic enter the picture? Yeah? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So the two questions are actually quite similar in their answer. Aramaic already in the time post-Mishnaic, you know, even not even post-Mishnaic, I mean, the Gemara points out that in the house of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, even the maids spoke Hebrew. I don't know if people are familiar with that too. Well, what does that tell you? Right, that was unique, right? And so therefore, we know that in Eretz Israel, in his era, there was a Greek-speaking world as well, and Aramaic. and Hebrew maintained certainly a scholarly language, right? It is a Zionist plot to claim that Hebrew was a dead language. Hebrew was not a vernacular, right? Eliezer ben Yehuda returned Hebrew to its status as a vernacular, which was either a good idea or not. I just saw an amazing quote from Gershom Shalom recently, who said that, you know, these fools, because of course he was contemporary, not with ben Yehuda, but he was a pretty early Zionist era, said these fools think you're going to reawaken a language that we've been imploring God in for thousands of years and God's not going to answer. Right? It's like he talks about the explosive potential of the Hebrew language. So Aramaic, meanwhile, already in the Second Temple period, it existed. Right? In fact, many people believe that the language of, say, Jesus of Nazareth was actually Aramaic. Certainly, by the time the Mishnaic period came to an end, that's why classically the distinction within the Gemara between the statements of the Tanaim and the statements of the Moraim, even though it's not by any means 100%, but classically, the distinction is that the Tanaim are speaking in Hebrew and the Moraim are speaking in Aramaic. Right? Aramaic continues as a common language amongst the masses, which is one of the explanations certain prayers are in Aramaic because they were better understood. Now, there are all kinds of other reasons. Like the sages say that the angels don't speak Aramaic, right? So that if you want a direct line to God and you don't have to go via the angels, you should always pray in Aramaic. Not really sure what that means, but I love it. And it persists, by the way. There are Aramaic-speaking villages in certain areas of Syria, Iraq, even today. There's not exactly the same Aramaic, and it's been quite a bit of time. One of the reasons it lives on, though, is you ever know anybody who speaks Yeshivish? You know what? Why do we develop jargons? There's two reasons we develop jargons. One is that they're quite accurate in their usage because they're specific to their context. Like when a yeshiva guy says, but what's pshat? So all the other guys know exactly what he means, but the average person doesn't, even if you know what the word pshat means, right? That's one reason, because jargon is useful because of its specificity. What's the other reason? Keeps the outsiders out, right? And you can keep the outsiders out, meaning it's an exclusionary tactic, and you see it in the Beit Midrash, right? I remember I was in my first year at the Mir. I was in an English language shir, but it was way over my head in general. And what was really frustrating is that the Rebbe, every time he got to the critical point in the Gemara, would use Yiddish terms. And I was completely lost. You know, and everybody else was nodding their heads because why? Because they had the key terms. And so Aramaic, to this day, will function that way. You read the rabbinic literature to this day. I saw it the other day with my chavruta. Anu sharinan, right? We permit. It doesn't say it's mutar. He says in Aramaic, we permit. First of all, who's the we? Sharinan. It doesn't say mutar. Mutar is like, it's an adjective. Sharinan is a verb. We permit. And furthermore, if you don't understand when I switch into Aramaic what I'm saying, then you're out of the discussion anyway. You understand how it works? Anyway, that's an aside. So here, we've got the problem within Rav Tzadja of this tension between the neoclassical longing for Hebrew and his real devotion. It wasn't just an abstract longing. Through poetry, through biblical exegesis, and through a lot of polemics. He was very into arguing with people, right? That he really helped to begin an awakening of the Hebrew language, which, like I said, will flower in Spain. The Rambam is one of the great, I wouldn't say products of it, because most of what the Rambam wrote was actually in Arabic, but the Mishneh Torah, which is the Rambam's great halachic work, was written in Hebrew. And some people feel it was a reflection of that same stream. So that's one side. The other side is that Rav Tzadja is serving the people. He translates the Bible into Arabic, and he wants to understand it properly, so he'll use the tools at hand of grammar, and that will have consequences down the line. And in that, I pointed out that he also, in addition to bringing poetry into the discourse of the Gaonim, brings biblical exegesis, that's a tough word, into the literary fold of the Gaonim. What else? I have one major thing left, but there's so much more. So yeah, question.
So
I'm not allowed to think. Yeah.
So I've learned that Sadia Gaon was responsible for the institution of the Shabbat candlelighting blessing a polemic against
the Karaites. Haven't heard it. Sounds entirely possible to me. One of the earliest works that we have from him is against Anan. Right? He was one of the major fighters against the Karaites. As I pointed out to you guys, that the early Gaonim, or even like up until Rav Saadia, weren't interested in fighting the Karaites, either because the Karaites were a fringe element that didn't affect them, or they felt they didn't want to dignify them, you know, by a response. But Rav Saadia was a fighter. So it's possible, you know, there are lots of questions about where the bracha, meaning you have to make a distinction between the custom of lighting Shabbat candles, which is in the Gemara, it's in the Mishnah, you know, and the idea that there's a blessing for it. So it's possible. I've never done any research. It makes sense to me what you're saying. We have a question there? It's okay.
I'm struggling my memory, but I did learn to play this song.
Uh-huh.
Did
she also attribute it to Rav Saadia?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's an interesting question. It's interesting. Like I said, even if it's not true, it still serves a good point of bringing out another element of Rav Saadia's life, which was always polemic. It was always polemic. I'll give you a little bit more about his life, and then I'll end on what I see to be actually the most important contribution intellectually and spiritually he makes to Am Yisrael. So we, like I said, he was born in 882. Right? And how did he become Gaon? Well, you know, the Academy of Surah had fallen on somewhat of hard times. And in the wake of the calendar controversy, which we spoke about last week, we said that Rav Saadia had sort of rocketed to prominence through that controversy, even though he wasn't he stepped forward into prominence, right? Pre-rocket era. Although who knows, the Chinese were probably already making fireworks. He came to prominence, and the exilarch, David ben Zakkai, looked to this sort of energetic young outsider to save the Academy of Surah. It's likely, in my estimation, he also looked to him as someone easy to control, because the Gaonim and the Exilarch always had a somewhat difficult relationship. And he probably figured that, you know, Rav Saadia, if he was going to be an outsider, outsiders are always dependent upon their patrons, right? And so he elevated him against, by the way, the advice of some of his closest advisors, who saw very clearly that he was a combative person and that he also was an outsider, which is a negative in many people's eyes. And so the Exilarch persevered, and at age 46, Rav Saadia became the first and, like I said, only non-Babylonian to serve as Gaon. And indeed, the academy thrived. Surah returned to its prominence that it had previously held and continued for many hundreds of years. However, a few years into his service as Gaon, Rav Saadia refused to confirm a judicial appointment that the Exilarch, his patron, David ben Zakkai, made. And in retaliation, the Exilarch actually announced that he was no longer Gaon, and he appointed an inferior scholar in his place. But Rav Saadia was not the type to back down. So what did Rav Saadia do? He excommunicated the Exilarch and appointed someone else in his place. Now, everything for the next 7 years goes now. By the way, I'm telling you this so you can feel better about Jewish community in general, that some things never change. For the next 7 years, even bribes to the Muslim authorities couldn't work to solve the problem of two basically armed camps within Babylon, each one claiming to have two Gaonim and their own exilarchate, etc. But eventually there was a reconciliation, and lo and behold, Rav Saadia was once again universally recognized as Gaon of Surah, right? And he died in 942 after serving for only 14 years of Gaon, and half that time under a very strained capacity. And one of the reasons, aside from the amusing part of the story, that it's important to know this is you have to appreciate the impact he managed to make within the space of 14 years, half of which was bound up with tremendous political controversy. So like I said, we have this question of language, which cuts both ways, the sort of the neoclassical revival of Hebrew and the building of the bridge to Arabic. We have the power of poetry, right, which when we get to the story of Spain, you'll see it plays a very important role within Spanish Jewish culture and Jewish culture in general. And last, but for sure not least, we have the question of theology. You know, classic rabbinic Judaism places very little weight on dogma, on the idea that there are statements of faith to which a person must adhere in order to be a Jew, right? And I pointed out to you that the Gaonim were the completion of the rabbinic project, and I specifically was laying the groundwork for this part of the discussion, said that it's a one-to-one relationship between law and identity, right? But you know, the Gemara doesn't really give you statements of faith. And if it does, it tends to do, where do you find the theology of the Gemara? You do, it's there. It's in the Agadata. Oh. It's in stories. So first of all, it's a general principle that we don't ask kashas from one midrash on the next, meaning that midrashim can be completely contradictory, and that's fine. It's not a problem, as opposed to law, where you have to work it out. Right? Second of all, narrative is eminently malleable. Right? How you read a story depends on how you approach it, what you bring to the table, you know, the context in which you embed it. So rabbinic theology, there are elements of rabbinic. It's not like they didn't think about these issues, but they weren't as definitive. Right? You know, even if you look at the list of like who has a portion in the world to come, the issues there are not necessarily issues of belief. There are one or two. I don't want to overstate the case. But theology as a systematic approach to belief is not what you find in the Gemara. There you'll find, like I wrote, the words I wrote down were complex, fragmented, often contradictory, and like I said, narrative. But Rav Sadia lived in a time when both Christianity and Islam were in the process of consolidating their thought into dogma. And what was interesting about the era in which Rav Sadia lived is that there was an institution within Islam which was known as the Kalam. The Kalam was basically what we would call an interfaith debate society. Right? There were these salons. I wrote down what the name is in Arabic. Oh, majalis. Right? They're basically intellectual salon meetings that reached their high point around the 11th century. And there, the mutakalimun, the people who participated in the kalam, in these debate societies, would meet and debate. By the way, if you've ever read the Rambam's Guide for the Perplexed, right, in the second section, the sort of, what's it called, comparative religion section, right, when he takes on the faith of Islam, he speaks about the kalam and the mutakalimun. Because there are certain elements of their philosophy which with he deeply disagreed. And he's speaking about the Muslim philosophers that came out of this process. But what he doesn't tell you is that this was an interfaith context, that Jews, Christians, and Muslims would come together and they would debate each other. Now, it's very important to understand this for two reasons. Number one, if you're going to debate, you have to have some sort of, agreed upon, playing field. You know what they excluded from their debates? Revealed scripture. Right? No one was allowed to bring proof from revelation. Why? Because it's like, well, my God says this, my God says that. Everybody reaches for their sword. There's really no sort of like solution to that. And so therefore, that leads us, there are three important, a natural consequence of that. Well, what were they going to rely upon for their argumentation? Reason. Right? Remember that Islam carried forward a lot of the basic structures of Greek philosophical culture, and many of the texts, in fact, and there is a re-encounter between Jewish thought and classical Greek thought, which happens in the Muslim world, and Rav Sadia is a very important part of that, in particular Aristotelian thought, that the thought which the rabbis had said, Aru ha'ish ha'milamed et beno chochmot yavan, cursed is the one who teaches their child Greek wisdom, and there's a lot of debates about what Greek wisdom is, but one could say in context it certainly included philosophy, right, is now going to become a critical tool in the quest to clarify the truth of revelation, right? So the other important piece, by the way, is that there has to be a safe political context for such a thing. I mean, the Kalam exists at a time where Islam is trying to figure itself out before it is really a consolidated state religion. It will be suppressed by Islam at the end of the 11th century, right? Because we don't want any more of this sort of free thinking kind of stuff. And it's interesting to me personally because I really wish that we as a people had the sort of guts and the capacity to reawaken such a process in our day and age, because the only place in the entire Middle East where it would be safe for Jews, Muslims, and Christians to get together and tell each other how they were right and wrong is here. It's probably the Jews that would stop it, though.
Unforced.
These are not the debates of medieval Christianity which were not that, and we'll speak about that. Thank you for making that clear. These are voluntary participatory processes where the belief, and this is the other piece I want to bring out, the belief was that reason and revelation are two paths to the same destination. And I'm going to say it again, because that's the critical piece that Rav Sadia brings into Jewish culture, and he passes on in particular to Spanish culture, and it will have powerful and sometimes disastrous results. Reason and revelation are two paths to the same destination. That these are all people that believe in truth, with a capital T, because they're all adherents of revealed religions, right? But they believe that there are two ways to arrive at the truth. One can receive it, God said, and then we can argue about whose prophet is right, but one can also reason toward it, which is why they felt it worthwhile to leave their scriptures at home and to face each other on the debate floor in order to try to get at the truth. You have a question or comment? The goal was to really to arrive at a purified conception of God. These were what we would today call theologians. And remember, not every theologian is interested in converting others. I mean, there are different impulses within religious thought. And the truth of the matter is, there are different types of theologians. There are those who we would call the sort of conversionary supremacist theologian, for whom the only way to be right is to have everyone to agree with you. Right? But there are also those who actually want to just know the truth. And even though they believe that they are right and you are wrong, nevertheless, that belief itself is what leads them to want to engage you, because truth is, you might be partially right.
So I have two questions about that. So would they talk about things like, what is the best way for us to live our lives? Would they talk about stripping away
They were more philosophical discussions, more toward the latter than the former. Remembering that at least Judaism and Islam share the assumption that God cares about your behavior, or your actions, I shouldn't say that, your specificity of actions. Christianity doesn't have such a strong impulse in believing that God cares about a specificity of action. But I want to—I have a few minutes left, and I don't want to drag Rav Sadia over into the next class. So that's the historical context, right, the kalam. Right, and
where was it taking place?
In these majalis, they were basically intellectual salons.
In
what? Probably the houses of wealthy people. What?
In
Babel. And at this point, just to be clear, they're under the Abbasid Empire, so the capital is Baghdad. The Abbasids built Baghdad, and even though we call Sura Sura and Pompidita, they were both in Baghdad at this point. They'd moved to the capital. So Rav Sadia basically becomes the most important of the Jewish mutakalimun, and he brings Jewish theology into a formal existence with his book. He writes in around 933 called Emunot V'Deot. Now, Emunot V'Deot, which I'm going to avoid translating right now, is a compilation of 10 essays, the focus of which is to extract theological principles from an incredible array of biblical verses. Until Rav Sadia gets to the Messianic vision, he is almost completely relying on biblical sources and not rabbinic thought, right? Which is interesting because of the context of the kalam, right? You can say there's different layers. There's pure reason, then there's scriptures, which to some degree all three of the religions shared at least an importance of, and then there's rabbinic thought, which is an internal Jewish discourse. And to me, it's fascinating that it's only when it comes to the Messiah that he's really focused on the rabbinic vision, right? But he gives in his introduction a very clear reason for what he's doing, and then a very important frame for how it is meant to be done. The reason is clear. He says, I saw men sunk, as it were, in seas of doubt and covered by waters of confusion, and there was no diver to bring them up from the depths and no swimmer to come to their rescue. And therefore, he says, I undertook this work in order that we may find out for ourselves what we know in the way of imparted knowledge from the prophets of God, and two, in order that we may be able to refute those who attack us on matters connected with our religion. And you hear these two elements. One is an internal. How do we properly serve God? What do we already know? That's why it's exegesis. He's going in detail, often very creatively, through these verses and trying to figure out, well, what is our inheritance from the prophets? The other element is polemic. And we're getting walloped by the Muslims and the Christians all the time. And I want to show them how they're all wrong. Right? And so those are the two impulses that are driving the book. And the other critical piece in the introduction is that Rav Sajja lays out an epistemology. Now, this is a major problem for the world today, and therefore it's one worth thinking about. What is epistemology? Epistemology is how we know anything. It's not what you know. It's how you know, right? And therefore, it's what allows us to distinguish between justified belief and opinion. Now, why do I say it's so important? Because how often do you hear today, well, that's how you see it. But I see it this way. You can't question my narrative. Now, there's truth to that, but it's a subjective lens which has gradually undermined and really is a product of the undermining of this idea of any shared epistemology. Right? Is there any way of knowing something which is not completely subjective? Right? So Rav Sajja gives four answers. And this is why I understand he chose the title of Emunot V'Deot. There are three, he says, there are three universally accepted sources of knowledge. Number one, sensory perception. Right? It says that starting point of knowledge is invariably of a concrete nature, and its final result is some abstract idea. But you always start from the world. And that's why, by the way, the one thing which is not subjective is pain. Right? Meaning, on some level, okay, there is a range there too, but on some level, you know, if someone starts speaking to you about, you know, the pain of your words, right, you can speak about the subjectivity of it. If I slap you, you cannot deny that I've just given you a blow. Right? I mean, how much it hurts. I don't mean how much it hurts one person or the other. We can have debates about whether my words should or shouldn't hurt you. If I reach out and give you one across the cheek, right, that leaves the realm of the subjective and enters what Rav Sajja calls sensory perception. That's number one. Number two, direct intellectual comprehension. This is what we call book learning. Right? You don't have to actually see a mountain to know that one exists. You can read about its description, even though obviously there's a very big difference. The third is what he calls logical reasoning, inference. What you know can allow you to figure out what you don't know. Where there's smoke, there's fire. You don't actually have to see the fire. You can deduce from the existence of the smoke something with neither your senses nor indirect information has provided you. He says that's the way the human mind works. He calls these universally accepted sources of knowledge. Those are emunot. They're just simply sort of inflexible, right? The fourth element, he says, is shared by all monotheists, because remember, he's part of this kalam, and he calls it authentic tradition. Authentic tradition, right? For us, what is that? It's Torah. It's Torah, right? And that's why I said this whole path is about reconciling reason and revelation. He says that, you know, sense perception, you know, direct intellectual comprehension and logic require time to understand and conceptualize, right? Learning is hard. It takes a long time. Not everybody is well equipped for it, right? And often people stop short and end up with wrong ideas, thinking that they've thought their way all the way through. And he points out that it's difficult. But he says authentic tradition can be considered immediate knowledge. You just got a letter that tells you, yeah, he calls the Torah a report that one can trust. Right? And therefore, it's an immediate source for certain knowledge, and therefore becomes the foundation for the use of reason. I want you to understand that this is what's happened to the world. Rav Sajja, consciously or not, is aware that you can convince yourself of anything, even with sensory perception, direct intellectual perception, and logic. You could build castles in the air. You can tell me that black is white, up is down, hot is cold, anything. So he says that the base for all use of reason in his eyes is revelation. It serves as the base for it. Remember, this is two paths that lead to the same place. He's just confident that revelation gets there, and he's not so sure that most people will get there by reason. But he goes further, and this is where the challenge really comes, because he says that we have an obligation to use reason to test revelation. I mean, the pasuk in Isaiah says, do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told to you from the beginning? Do you not understand the foundations of the earth? He says there's an obligation to use reason to remove all doubt and errors from one's thoughts about revelation. That without revelation, reason has no anchor. And then he points out, however, without reason, revelation is in the danger of descending into what we would call superstition. Right? And so he says there's an obligation to believe. That's emunot v'deo. I mean, he's Rav Sadia Gaon. He's not questioning. He's the one that will tell you that God spoke in Hebrew and so did all humanity until they blew it at the Tower of Babel. Right? And so therefore, revelation to him is a sort of a non-negotiable. And therefore, all powers of reason rest upon it. Which is interesting in the postmodern era, which is a lot of the problem of reasoning today comes, in my eyes, from a lack of any basis for epistemology. There are all kinds of philosophical searches going on right now. Right? The best that people have been able to come up with is what's called intersubjectivity. You guys know what I mean? It's very simple. What color is this page? Says who? Right? You can't prove to me that this page is white. Not in any absolute sense. But what can you prove to me? That what color is this bag? What color is this page? So if I can get enough people to agree on that, that's what's called intersubjectivity. There's no objective reality to the color, but we have a subjective experience which we share. Right? And that today is basically the only basis for any sort of shared existence, because as I pointed out to you, left just with the tools of reason, we can construct almost any world that we want. Except don't try to fly. That's my advice to you. I mean, without an airplane. But Rav Sadia sees the knife as cutting in both directions. Two paths, reason and revelation, both of which lead to the same truth, each of which is meant to support and sort of critically clarify the others. Right? And so he now has laid the groundwork to basically allow the Middle Ages to unfold. Because he's given us, I'll say the last piece later maybe. He's built the bridge between Arabic culture and Jewish culture, which allows the Torah to continue to thrive amongst many non-Hebrew speakers. Right? He gave us the poetry, which particularly in Spain, but also in Ashkenaz, will become a hallmark of medieval culture. He opened the doors to biblical exegesis, right? Both in the grammatical sense and the tools of grammar, which are going to become increasingly important in the Middle Ages, but also in this very idea that such a topic is worthy of discussion, right? It had belonged to the Karaites up until now, right? And now here he's giving us foundation for Jewish theology, not just the foundation, but the first true work of Jewish theology in Emunot V'Deot. As a side note, I didn't mention it, but he also brought the Yerushalmi back into the discussion of the Gaonim. Remember, we spoke about these two Talmuds. And the Gaonim, of course, the masters of the Babylonian Talmud. Rav Sadia, having had his education in the land of Israel, was also a master of the Amoraic tradition of Eretz Israel, and he brought it back into the discourse of the Gaonim, which if you know anything about the culture of, say, the Tosafists in Ashkenaz, these are the hallmarks of the way they learn. And that comes straight from Rav Sadia's efforts, if not from him personally, since he was already gone by the time that they came into being. And I just want to point out that that last piece of theology is a powerful and problematic move in Jewish history. On one hand, the attempt to integrate reason and revelation is one of the ways in which Rav Sadia is demonstrating how, through an engagement of current culture, the Torah will always be a source of creativity and relevance. it wasn't current culture in the sense that it was Greek culture being brought forward by the Arabic world, but for Rav Sajja, as the great Gaon of Sura, to step into basically a challenge match with the great thinkers of Islam and Christianity, and you know, and unafraid duke it out, right? You could see that the Torah was a tremendous source of pride, creativity, and relevance. The Jews that were there, and these were spectator sports, the Jews that were there walked away saying, hey, we got a champion, right? You know, and then when they heard he had a book, it was like, great, I want to read that too, right? So on one hand, it's a tremendous source, of, like I said, of creativity and renewal and relevance, and it's something we will see throughout the generations, that those wise who are willing to engage the world as it is will always be a source of creativity and renewal. On the other hand, right, we know that the last attempt at a reconciliation between the Torah and Greek philosophy didn't end all that well. Right? It was Philo of Alexandria who was deeply bothered by the nature of Greek philosophy and the Torah. And you guys remember, those of you who were in the class last year, what was his solution? Allegory. Right? That the Torah doesn't actually mean what it says. It actually sort of has a deeper inner meaning, if you recall, the technical uses of allegory. And what culture grew out of that? Christianity. Right? That by basically lowering the Torah to the level of philosophy, Philo unintentionally opened the door for a lot of Jews to walk away from it. And this sort of two-track approach of reason and revelation that Rav Sajja is now bringing right back to the fore. And notice, he translates the Torah into Arabic just like happened to the Septuagint. He will create this comparison between philosophy and revelation, just like happened by Philo. There's a tremendous parallel to this generation. On one hand, it will sort of lay seeds that will flower tremendously in Spain. On the other hand, when push comes to shove to Spanish Jewish culture under Christianity in the 15th century, right, we're going to see that philosophy becomes one of the major tools for undermining the adherence to the Torah. And so, since we're not going to learn the history of Spanish Jewry together, we need to appreciate both the power and the problematic of what it was that Rav Sajja did there. But in his day, he was unquestionably the Gaon, and really, in thought, probably the single most important influence in creating the Jewish Middle Ages. So that's it. We're done with Rav Sajja. We'll pick up, I guess, with the beginnings of the Rishonim next week.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.